This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. The North Carolina General Assembly goes back into session Tuesday. Lawmakers will consider Governor Pat McCrory's vetoes of two bills. One requires drug testing for certain welfare recipients. The other grants immigration exemptions for some seasonal workers. These two bills were just a small fraction of the laws passed during the General Assembly session. Republican lawmakers were in control of both the House and the Senate, as well as the governor's mansion. And by any measure, the past session was a success for the GOP. We invited a panel of conservatives to talk about the state of the Republican Party in North Carolina. Becky Gray is with us, Vice President of Outreach at the John Locke Foundation. Brian Balfour is Director of Policy at Civitas Institute. And conservative political consultant Mark Roderman is with us as well. Welcome to all of you.
Good to have you here.
Great to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Becky, let me ask you, let's talk about this veto session coming up, too, on the table. Let's start with the drug testing for welfare recipients. Is this a good law?
Well, obviously, the General Assembly thinks so. This passed with bipartisan support by a pretty big margin. So they sent it over to the governor's office, as they did many other bills, and he vetoed it. He has expressed concerns with the implementation of it. I think that I've read that he thinks that perhaps this is a good idea to have some kind of checks and balances put into place for people who are receiving taxpayer-funded benefits, and to make sure that the money is not being used for a drug addiction problem, and if they are, then perhaps find some help for those folks. He has expressed concerns with the implementation of that, whether or not there's enough money set aside in the budget and whether the infrastructure is in place to really follow through with this. Those are his concerns with the bill. Obviously, the General Assembly felt like they had those bases covered. So as we're moving closer to Tuesday and this override session, sort of the scuttlebutt, if you will, within the Republican caucus. And of course, the Republican caucus in the House, which is where the vetoes will start. Both of these bills are House bills, so they'll start in the House. The Republicans hold a 77-member advantage in the House. I think they need 70 votes if all of the members are there. Three-fifths is required of those members voting and present for a veto vote. So as we're hearing from the leadership of the Republican caucus, Rules Chairman Tim Moore, Majority Leader Edgar Starnes, Majority Whip Mike Hager, over the last couple weeks, we're really starting to get indications that there is a real appetite to override both of these bills.
Well, so let's talk about that, Mark, because here's something it seems to me the chief executive could have worked out within his party before these bills got to him. Hey, I don't think there's enough enforcement. I'm a little concerned about this. I have to veto. On the other hand, he's a man who can count, and it wouldn't be hard to get to the number needed to override that veto and know that maybe this would look like a defeat for him. What's going on with the Republican Party? Why couldn't they work this out first?
I would characterize this as a disagreement among the family, and I think that he is going to be overridden. I think the base wants this. I think the General Assembly wants it. I think the governor stood on principle. But in this case, and I don't think it long-term hurts the governor, but I think in this case he'll be shut down by the General Assembly on both those bills.
Let's talk about the immigration bill, Brian. The governor says again that because of the way it's set up, this would allow sort of more visas for agricultural workers. He's worried that this bill would in effect mean more illegal workers taking jobs from those who are here legally. And there are a number of sheriffs across the state who apparently agree and would like to sustain this veto, and they've said as much.
Right. My understanding is this has to do, it's related with the E-Verify program for employers, checking on the status of their workers. And according to the governor, it created too large of an exemption for two, I can't recall exact number of days, but for too large of a time period throughout the year, and would expand and apply more to more than just the primarily seasonal workers that it had previously. And certainly, I think there's some legitimate concerns, and you mentioned the sheriffs are on board with the governor's opposition to it or his veto to it. And certainly a lot of Civitas readers, feedback we've gotten from them, once they understood the governor's rationale for it, they kind of picked up on that and were in support of Governor McCrory's veto of that bill specifically because of that aspect. So it will be interesting to see if maybe they try to rework that bill At all, or if it's just a straight veto override or not.
Becky?
Yeah, and as you said, there have been groups that have expressed support for the veto and those who have expressed support for overriding the veto. And one very large group, sort of community within North Carolina, is the agricultural community. I think Agriculture Commissioner Troxler, as well as the Farm Bureau, and again, the agribusiness community in North Carolina have gone to the airways. They have been, I understand, making telephone calls, contacting legislators, urging the override of this veto. Their concern is that they can't get the crops in even immediately this session without the workers, the migrant workers, coming in to do it. Their argument is these are jobs that North Carolina, unemployed North Carolinians are not willing to take, and they have got to have those workers from other countries to come in to help with that. So it's been an interesting kind of dynamic of, you know, the business industry and a real immediacy to this need as we're finishing up this harvesting of the crops.
Yeah, I think the farmers and the Farm Bureau would characterize this as an urgent need.
Mm-hmm. Well, but also the whole issue of immigration, I think, points to a split within the Republican Party generally. And I want to talk about how that plays out here in North Carolina. Business conservatives want more workers in this state and in this country to do the work that isn't being done. But there's a base, a kind of Tea Party base, that is worried about the influx of outsiders into the country. And that's been a powerful ideological tool and issue for the Republicans, and has split the Republican Party. Does it play out the same way, do you think?
I think there is a split. I just wouldn't characterize it as business community. I think there's a lot of conservatives and Republicans in Congress who want to uphold the rule of law, and they also think the McCain bill that's been passed through the Senate that Obama signed off on is just too top-heavy with pork and everything else and really doesn't fix the borders. I mean, I think a lot of Republicans, if the borders were secure, would then sign off on a path to citizenship. But I don't think it goes anywhere in the House without the securing the borders first.
And Mark brings up an interesting point, too. This is a discussion not only within the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, I think, as well, business community, you know, all of those different factions. But there's also the discussion of what should be done at the congressional level, at the federal level, and then what can we do at the state level, and where do those paths cross, and where are they totally separate? Well, so that's the other thing that I think we're seeing in this discussion.
Well, what's clear is you're not getting any real guidance from the Obama administration at all. I mean, they've just thrown up their hands, and they're letting almost anybody through, and I would view it as a national security imperative that we know who's coming in at a time of terror, who's coming into this country. That's one reason to secure the borders. I don't think you can have a sovereign nation without having secure borders.
Well, this latest legislation adds 290,000 border guards and expands the fence by 700
miles. Well,
that's
what they say. But we'll see if it would be implemented. I don't think it's got a chance with Goodlatte, who's on the Judiciary Committee in the House.
Well, let's talk about this question of who's in charge and what kind of leadership, and get back to the state of North Carolina. This is McCrory's first General Assembly session. Was he in charge? And how do you think he did, Mark?
Well, look, I think it was a shakeout period for his team, for gubernatorial, for the governor's office. I think the action was in the House and Senate. Obviously, Berger's been there a lot longer than McCrory. All right, but I think the governor all in all came out very well. The proof will be in the pudding whether we create jobs and we pave the roads. Okay, if the unemployment is down in 2016 substantially, so he'll be reelected. If it's not, he's got problems.
Brian, how do you think he did?
I think overall the General Assembly and, of course, the governor, I think they did very well. I mean, you look at the list of accomplishments, certainly from our perspective, you know, things that Civitas Institute has been advocating for years, a lot of those were implemented. We talk about significant tax reform. It's been, praised by, for instance, Americans for Tax Reform, a national group, as the most substantial state tax reform improvement in a state tax code in many, many years. You look at election reform, including the voter ID, which has been, that's one of the most consistently popular policies that we've pulled for the last several years in terms of just simple fact of presenting a photo ID when you go to vote. We look at a statewide school choice program that the legislature implemented. I mean, all of these have been polled, at least by us, as to being very popular positions, and fights that in other states have traditionally taken years and years to finally implement. So this legislature, once the state had the Republican governor, Republican conservative majorities in the General Assembly, we were able to accomplish pretty significant reforms in one session. The amount of reforms that could take years and years and years in most other states. So, and I think that's in part why you saw some of the backlash too.
As a conservative, you've got to be happy with what transpired.
You've got to be conservative. Right.
But if you're the governor, you're not happy because his poll numbers are down, very severely down. So if all of these were such popular initiatives, why is he doing
but
so poorly?
But that comes a long time before the next election.
Right. A couple points too. His poll numbers are about where Beverly Perdue's were at the same point in her administration. His poll numbers are not too far off where Obama's poll numbers are. But here's the thing. I think that Governor Corey should be very pleased and feel very good about this session. Because not only, as Brian outlined, there were some real conservative victories during this short session, but there also were some real victories for Governor McCrory, some things that he wanted. In addition to tax reform, it was also very important to him that he get some authorization to restructure the Commerce Department, to put that together more like he wanted it done. And that happened. He also was very interested in setting the framework for Medicaid reform. You know, if there was a big bump, if there was a big problem, a big wall that they came up against this session, it's Medicaid and that growing expense that, you know, and the surprises that was out of control. He wanted some authority to really get that under control and make substantive reforms. That was put into place. So I think the other big victory that the governor had was transportation reform and the way that we have restructured the equity formula of how we're going to pay for roads and infrastructure in North Carolina. So I think that, you know, I'm not sure who is in charge, but I think that the governor had a very good session.
We'll talk some more about this. Take a little break right here and come back. Becky Gray, Vice President for Outreach at John Locke Foundation, Brian Balfour, Director of Policy at the Civitas Institute, and conservative political consultant Mark Roderman. Our conversation on the Republican Party and its future in North Carolina continues on North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned to the State of Things. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today talking about the state of the North Carolina Republican Party, and with us Becky Gray, Vice President for Outreach at the John Locke Foundation. Brian Balfour is Director of Policy at the Civitas Institute and conservative political consultant Mark Roderman. So before the break, you were talking about the fact that the governor got control of Medicaid, and yet to do this, it meant not expanding Medicaid, and it meant turning back hundreds of millions of dollars in federal money. It means a lot of people are going to be looking for medical care, didn't extend unemployment benefits, so a lot of people are going begging on that score. How does this play? How does this work in the favor of the governor as people are looking for medical care in the next 2 or 3 years?
Well, as we were talking during the break, I think the governor needs to take a victory lap along with Berger and Tillis, but particularly Senator Berger, because Berger's not, I don't think, running for any other office at this point. And I would go around and explain what we did to the local newspapers, and I'd go around and talk to the local television stations in the fall and explain to the public what he did with Medicaid, what he did with reforming taxes, and how that's going to impact their lives. I think there, you know, you have to – redundancy means a lot in politics.
I think, you know, as far to answer your question on Medicaid and the unemployment thing, here's the message that I think they need to talk about is that what they are doing is fixing government rather than expanding broken systems. And you've heard the governor talk a lot about that. But the fact of the matter is, we found out in January through a series of audits from the state auditor's office, Beth Wood, that we have huge overruns in Medicaid. We have huge no cost containment, waste, fraud to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, if you're going to get that under control, if you're going to get the state's fiscal house in order, you've got to start addressing those things. You cannot allow them to go on, and you certainly cannot expand them. You know, you've heard this thing, well, we lost all this federal money. You know, that's not free money. Where do you think that comes from? It comes from taxpayers. So this was an effort to get Medicaid under control, to start to put some cost containment measures in place, to focus on improving health care for North Carolinians before we expand a program that is terribly broken and bleeding taxpayer money.
Right, but the money is, forgive me, but it isn't coming from taxpayers. It came from taxpayers, so that money's already been taken out and it's in the Treasury, and now it's not coming back to North Carolina to be respent into the system. But but as a practical matter, let me ask you this. You're talking about fixing a system, but it means that people aren't going to be treated. And as a practical political matter, if people go without medical care and start complaining and feeling bad about not being able to get health services, and that number expands, what does that mean politically? Can you really have a publicity campaign to tell people how miserable they aren't?
No, I think what Becky was talking about, an economy efficiencies and what's going on with Medicaid, and it's fairly inefficient, says to say the least. So I think you can still accommodate those people with what the governor did, and I would defer to Becky on that. But I just say I don't see a lot of folks that are, you know, frankly can't get health care in this state.
And one thing that's been overlooked when we're talking about accepting the federal expansion of Medicaid is when you look at the state's program, kind of piggybacking on what Becky was alluding to, I mean, the program in terms of the number of people enrolled has been exploding over the last decade. We've added roughly about 600,000 people onto this program in the last decade, and at the same time, there's fewer physicians willing to see Medicaid patients. So we see more and more of these people flooding into this Medicaid program with fewer and fewer doctors to see. So that's not really access to care at all. And this Medicaid expansion from the federal level would have added, by some estimates, up to another 500,000 people on there. I mean, who are these people going to see? I don't think we would have been doing them any favors by accepting that Medicaid expansion, because we just would have been basically stuffing more people onto this already overcrowded system.
Well, you seem to be the perfect panel for this, though. This seems to be a market question. There is a demand for this kind of care. How do we meet it? Because the people who access this can't afford to pay out of their pockets, and they don't get insurance from any other source, and there's a demand. So just from the market standpoint, how do you meet a demand for medical care in the state of
North Carolina? Exactly why the governor pushed so hard for Medicaid reform, and why his proposal on Medicaid reform is something that is really being pushed. Again, to Mark's point, getting efficiency in place. One of the things that they're considering is to put some kind of competition into the providers and into these insurance packages, if you will, that will be available to folks, so that they could, just because someone is poor doesn't mean that they can't make good choices. And so in order to give these folks choices in what kind of health insurance do you need, what will best fit your need, your family's need, you know, let's bring that in. And instead of doing a one size fits all and hope that somebody gets the treatment that they need, let's really take a look at this and put some measures in place so that the product, the outcome for these patients is being well served, and also that the taxpayer money is being well used. So those are the kind of things that they're looking at. It's a different way of looking at government, rather than just expanding to do more and more and more, to really focus on how those dollars are spent and what the outcomes are.
And clearly what was happening wasn't working.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, let's unravel all the government interventions into the medical care and healthcare field that were causing the prices to become so unaffordable for many people. And let's begin to, and rather than creating more government programs to compound the problem, let's start unraveling all those government interventions and restrictions and let that market work. As you mentioned, there's a demand for health insurance and medical care service, obviously. Let's let intelligent, talented, creative individuals in the insurance field and the medical delivery field, you know, come and create the efficiencies and the most efficient means to create, and to meet those demands.
Can't you do that while you're still serving people with a somewhat hobbled system? We don't like this system, but at least I can come in and see a doctor instead of telling those 500,000 people, I don't have anything for you. Can't we do both and say, all right, this is not good, but we're talking about human people who are really not feeling well. Let's fix them while we're fixing the system, and then come back and say, we've got a much better plan here. Let's replace that old thing that wasn't working so well with the one that is, but in the meantime, treat those people.
Well, that assumes they were being taken care of, and I'm not sure that's the case.
It's 500,000 people who could have been brought in under this plan who will not be now. And so what do you say to them to say, sorry, we're closed for repairs. Come back with your broken arm or your chronic illness in 2 years when we got it figured out.
Well, again, I would say that there's a lot of inefficiency in the Medicaid system. And I think those 500,000 people will be taken care of with what the governor did. And I just don't see the backlash that you're speaking about.
Well, let's talk some more about that and change gears a little bit and talk about the backlash in Moral Mondays and whether or not what this means for the Republican Party. There's a sense that there is a growing organization now that voter ID might have the effect of registering more Democratic voters, that Moral Mondays might have galvanized an otherwise sleepy opposition. What effect do you think it's going to have, Brian?
Lasting effect, it'll be very interesting. I mean, we're still a ways away, obviously, from McCrory's reelection. And you look at some of the, at least in the short term, some of the movement in the poll numbers. I think it has had, at least in the short term, an effect. But one of the things that's interesting, we like to survey people across the state over how closely they're paying attention to some of the issues and what's going on in state government. And once you get outside of major markets, you know, like Raleigh and Charlotte and Durham and so forth, a lot of people just really do not follow along very closely. But one of the things that the protests have had a little bit of an impact is they've been able to find those folks that are not really familiar with what the General Assembly did specifically, but then they are reading about the protests. So basically their only source of information is saying, well, I'm not really sure what the General Assembly did, but there's a lot of people upset about it. So at least in the short term, you know, until those people, Mr. Roderman was talking about, until some of those people maybe can get educated, and if it's the McCrory administration or whoever that goes out and really tries to inform them in terms of what the benefits really are going to be because of these policy changes, you know, there could be an uphill battle.
Look, I think it was great theater. It didn't affect the legislation at all. I don't think it will impact the 2014 elections at all. And it's unclear to me whether to impact 2016. Truthfully, Becky has written a lot about the voter ID program and what's transpired. And we're not much different than 30 states. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Right. Now, as far as the voter ID, 33 states require an ID when you go mm-hmm. to vote. North Carolina would be the 34th state to do that. You know, many provisions that are in this election law that have been, we've heard it called the most suppressive voter law in the country and other things like that. The fact of the matter is that's just not true. What this does is it brings North Carolina more in line with what other states do. And before this law passed, we had some of the most liberal election laws in the country. Since this law has passed, we still have some of the most liberal laws in the country. So think at the end of the day, you know, to be honest with you, some of these issues that you've heard a lot about with the Moral Monday and the protests that they are concerned about, the voter ID, the abortion issue, the teacher tenure and teacher pay issue, I think that at the end of the day, the effects of this legislation and these policies that have been put into place, people are going to see at their pocketbook, with their jobs, with the economy, and those are the kind of issues that are really going to impact people's lives. I think by the time we have our elections in November of 14, a lot of this will be settled down. Those people who are concerned about it as they go to the polls and see that they're able to vote under these new laws and regulations and, as they call, restrictions, I think they're going to see that our elections are going to be just fine. By 2016, when you actually have to show your photo ID in order to cast your vote in North Carolina, I think that people are going to see, you know, this was just not as big a deal as people will think about. The things that they're going to remember, the things that will really impact people's lives, I believe, have to do with comprehensive tax reform, with bringing those rates down, with regulatory reform, going in and looking at the 22,000 rules that we have in addition to our laws, looking at those and putting periodic reviews on, do they still make sense? What's the cost associated with that? We start to see the transportation money spent to relieve congestion, make sure that our roads are safe, those kind of things. I think those are the issues where it's really going to impact people's lives over the long run.
Where they can see tangible results.
So we'll see. And if that's how it plays out, then that'll be an interesting scenario in the next couple of years. A lot of the credit for the Republican successes in this session goes to some of the places that you work for. A lot of credit goes to ALEC, which is a national group, and local think tanks like Civitas and John Locke. ALEC is sort of a national conservative legislative group that is writing some of the legislation here and in other states. John Locke and Civitas, do you think that they account for some of the success, John? Or Brian?
Oh, well, sure. We'll take plenty of credit for the success.
He'll probably give you an 800 number.
yeah. Check us out.
Don't get a tote bag with that.
But yeah, I mean, I think, again, these are ideas we've been writing about for years and years. So I think it was helpful that when once the governor, Republican governor, was in place to team up with the conservative legislature, I mean, there was a template there of information, of research by, you know, groups like ourselves and John Locke Foundation that legislators can turn to and really help to promote and sell their ideas and really get a better grasp on the policies and what the impacts will be. So I certainly, again, you know, patting ourselves on the back, but I certainly do think that we played an important role.
I would agree with Brian. The John Locke Foundation has been around for almost 24 years. We are only here in North Carolina. We worked on North Carolina issues. Mark was part of our original team, so we owe him a tip of the hat, certainly. But, you know, as Brian said, we've been talking about these issues. The John Locke Foundation, before I joined them, you know, has been an advocate for these conservative, free market, limited government, personal responsibility, preserving liberty and freedom for, again, you know, 24 years. So, and a lot of these things that we're seeing go into place in 2010 with the Republican majority in the General Assembly and then certainly with Governor McCrory's election in 2012, you're just starting to see these ideas flourish. There's a more fertile ground, if you will, for these ideas. But a lot of this stuff has been proposed and been introduced in bills for a number of years. We've certainly been writing about it, advocating for it, explaining it, doing the research for a number of years. So
the Locke Foundation has been doing a budget since its inception.
Right.
And given, yes. And John Hood particularly has been giving thought to these policy issues since we started. I think it is a free market conservative perspective. I think it was almost a perfect storm for the governor.
There's a lot of concern, that your founder, Art Pope, good friends with the Koch brothers, founders of the Tea Party movement, and that there's a lot of outside money that goes into ALEC, which has written the template for much of the legislation. A lot of concern that this outside money is writing legislation for North Carolina that isn't specific, a kind of, if you want to call it, one size fits all. There it is again. And a concern that it really doesn't represent what North Carolinians want, but it's a kind of part of a national conservative agenda.
I'm always puzzled by that. You know, first of all, you know, these are ideas that people like. Brian's organization does polling every month that indicate these kind of free market tax reform, regulatory reform, Medicaid reform, all of education reform, school choice. All of these things are things that North Carolinians like. There are individuals on both sides and organizations on both sides of issues that put their time and money and resources and efforts into it. Art Pope has certainly been involved in state government, state legislature. He served in the legislature at two different stints. He's been recruited by the McCrory administration to serve in that administration as the state budget director. The ALEC is a national organization. There are other organizations. The North Carolina State Legislative Association is another one that proposes legislation and does things. So, you know, there's a lot of these organizations, a lot of thought leaders, if you will, across the country, across the state, on both sides of the aisle.
I think that's a natural, too. And by the way, Art does not serve on any of these boards anymore, and he's doing the budget director job for $1 a year.
Right.
For the governor. Right. Mark, you've talked about the split that you saw in the Republican Party here in North Carolina in particular, saying that it's one of the biggest splits within a party that you've ever seen.
Well, I think in a whole, the country, I think there's a big split between the establishment nationally and between the grassroots, and you see that manifest itself with defunding Obamacare. You see that on immigration. I think the establishment is woefully out of touch with the grassroots in this country, and I think the establishment K Street party of the Republican wing has brought us Romney and McCain, which frankly, you know what the results were there. So I think Reagan would have embraced the Tea Party.
Why is that true? Shouldn't it be obvious to even the folks on K Street that there's where the money is?
Well, it's not the money. It's the grassroots help.
Well,
what I'm saying is that they're not listening. Big business and K Street vote their pocketbooks. That's not the same as what the grassroots want, in my opinion.
But that reflects a real political difference. I
it
mean,
does
there is
play.
Somebody's,
and there's
that
a,
is
there's
the,
a debate. I don't
right?
think it's healthy for Chris Christie who, by the way, I don't think will ever be president, because I think anybody that went to 100 Springsteen concerts needs their head examined. But the point being is, I don't think it does any good for him to engage in a debate, in a really petty debate, and slap down Ron Paul, who has got a great constituency.
The music critique, by the way, from a guy who had a radio show on KUSP in Santa Cruz, hippie radio. You did rock and roll DJ, so I guess you're authorized to do the critique on Springsteen. But let me ask you this, one other thing. This issue, and it may be insignificant, but it's interesting and it's in the headlines. Two of McCrory's, Pat McCrory's former campaign staffers get big salaries in the positions of Department of State and Health and Human Services. People are upset, a lot of money. Young folks, their biggest experience was they liked Pat McCrory and they served in his campaign. Should we be upset about that, Becky?
Well, it's certainly something that people can relate to, and the press has certainly picked it up and run with it. You know, the fact of the matter is, Governor McCrory was elected as the governor of North Carolina. He gets to put together a staff, and, you know, these are non-exempt positions, or exempt positions, I guess I always get that mixed up. You know, I mean, he is perfectly entitled to hire these people. He also, the way that it's set up, is he can pay them what he feels like they're worth. These are young men that he knew because they worked on his campaign at a pretty high level, and this is a decision that he has made. Now, whether it was the right one or the wrong one, we can certainly argue that, but I think that he is well within his rights to do this.
I think that's a perception problem for the governor and his administration. And I think that's a perception problem with the blue collar. And I think you need folks to look at that before they make these appointments and give these salaries.
But there's always going to be those questions, and I think it's healthy, and I think that it's something that we should do. First of all, for transparency within state government, how taxpayer money is being spent. And I think at every level, we need to ask those questions.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Becky Gray, Vice President for Outreach at the John Locke Foundation, Brian Balfour, Director of Policy at the Civitas Institute, Mark Rodiman, former DJ and now conservative political consultant. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Coming up live, The Hotel. Stay tuned.